This is Kevin Conroy, the voice of Batman.
This is Will Friedle, the voice of the future Dark Knight, Batman Beyond.
And you're listening to the DCAU Review, hosted by Cal and Liam.
Streaming at DCAUReview.com and on your favorite podcast app.
In the year 2039, Gotham City has no heroes. Its people, no hope. Its youth, no future.
Evening, boys and girls, who's up for some laughs?
Terry McGinnis was part of the problem.
You can't control your temper, and you'd better if you expect to get anywhere in life.
Yeah, I'll be a big success, just like you.
Until a moment of violence brought him to the door of a man named Bruce Wayne.
Let's put a smile on his face.
Leave him alone. Once known as the Batman.
Man, you're something. You okay?
Now, the Dark Knight will rise again to drive the shadow of evil from the streets of Gotham. Let's go! Supervillains, beware! There's a new Batman in town. Batman Beyond.
You're pretty strong for some clown who thinks he's Batman.
I am Batman.
Justice returns to Gotham. Welcome to my world.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 294 of the DCAU Review. I am Liam, and with me, as he always is Cal. Cal, we are continuing, and kind of for the time being, though not for the final time this year, we are wrapping up this month of Batman Beyond focused reviews and episodes. Instead of an episode to review this week, we're bringing back an old favorite, that is the character spotlight, but with a bit of a twist, as we have not one, but two of Batman Beyond's Rogues Gallery to spotlight, because as we've discussed in the past, there's not a ton of extracurricular merch and comic book tie-ins for these characters as there are with some of our main Batman Superman villains. So we had to scrape together a couple of them together, and then we also have a little bonus section at the end of just some fun, awesome, weird Batman Beyond merchandise that was made back in the day. But we are starting off first and foremost with our character spotlight this week on two of the more popular and more memorable rogues from Batman Beyond.
Absolutely. And another reason why we cover this, and for better or for worse, there's less Batman Beyond than almost any other show. Mm-hmm. So shorter run. And they didn't reuse villains as much. So you have only a couple of episodes to go through. And then on top of that, villains weren't really overused for the series. So yeah, we'll be talking about two that I believe deserve a spotlight, at least based on them being quite memorable and important to the series. And that is the femme fatale combo of Ink and Curare, who will both be highlighting today. And as we've done in the past with our spotlight episodes, we'll be talking a little bit about the episodes that they appeared in. We'll also talk about some of the other items that kind of make these characters themselves, both in their design, their music that was assigned to them, and the compositions that were done by our dynamic music partners for the series, as well as some voice, pointing out voice acting, well, voice acting for one of our, Femme Fatales, because the other one is mute.
Well, and there is technically we'll get to that. There is someone assigned to Kira RA, even though
that's right.
She never speaks. So we'll touch on that very briefly, as you mentioned.
Yeah, that's right. But we'll be covering that. And as you mentioned, we got a fun little bit at the end. Because of a lack of merchandise for Batman Beyond, also, we decided to highlight some of the wacky things we did find when looking for merchandise for these two characters. But yeah, we'll do all that in just a moment here. But before we kick that off, I will remind everybody listening at home that you can support the podcast, and we love our supporters that do, in a bunch of different ways. But one really important one that helps us out is leaving us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast app. And if you listen to us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a little blurb for a 5-star review, leave a little paragraph about what you like about the podcast as a thank you. If you reach out to us after we read your review on the air and you live in the continental United States, we'll send you a little gift as a thank you. So no new reviews this week to read, but that could be you on the next episode. So if you're listening to this episode now, go right now to Apple and leave a 5-star review and a little blurb, and then slide into our DMs, because we'd love to say thank you. But we, of course, Liam, are heard each and every week, not only on our favorite podcast apps, but also at youtube.com/thePodTower, which is also a proud sponsor of this very show. Don't forget, we'd love for you to subscribe to that channel. Not only do you get our complete library of podcasts and new episodes each and every single week, you also get new episodes from the Jump on the Batwagon podcast, which is currently going through both, I believe, the new Batman Adventures and Superman Adventures at the same time. And they also have gone through the entire Batman the Animated Series run themselves. There's also the entire Tim Talk catalog, which covered everything from the start of the DCAU all the way up to and including the end. So lots of great content there for you. We invite you to head on over today. Support us. Support those awesome podcasts over at youtube.com/thePodTower.
That is right, Cal. So we will get into our first character that we are spotlighting this week. And that is, of course, the character of Ink, one of the first big bads introduced, as we'll go through all of her episode appearances. But a little bit of background here. The character design of Ink is actually created. This was a character just bouncing around in the head of one James Tucker, who, of course, at the start of this show, though he would go on to be a producer and showrunner in his own right, on this show was still working as a character designer and storyboard artist, and would actually get his break as a director on Batman Beyond as well. But this Ink character, the name and the design were by James Tucker, and then with his visual flair, along with, I'm sure, some input from Bruce Timm and Shane Glines and some of the other character designers, we have this incredibly memorable design. We talked, I think, way back when we reviewed this probably about how the Ink is kind of a great example of taking a motif that is familiar, that being this sort of shape-changing, stretching characters. There's plenty of those bouncing around in comic books, in both major comic book companies. But Ink just visually stands out immediately, because not only because it's a female character, but just because of how she uses her powers, and that really striking, I mean, for lack of a better term, that inky look, the blue and black sort of marbling look of the character, she immediately stands out among all of the other stretchy clay shape-shifting characters in the pantheon of comic books.
Well put. Yeah, I agree with you completely. The DCAU wiki also has a quote from Mr. Tucker, who mentions that he, when he was doodling and kind of drawing around the character, Bruce Timm stumbled upon this character design and asked him what it was. And he said he didn't really know. It's this weird globby character. And at that point, Bruce jotted down the name. James had actually named her Inque, I-N-Q-U-E. So that's where she got the name. So very cool that Mr. Tucker is credited with creating that character. The first of many great ideas to come out of that brilliant mind that is Mr. Tucker's. But yeah, she does, as you mentioned, we've talked about it, it's familiar but different, and the way that the character is portrayed and the way that her powers sort of manifest do separate her. She's not just Clayface Beyond. She's not just a Plastic Man knockoff or an Elongated Man knockoff or Mr. Fantastic knockoff or whatever stretchy guy you want to talk about. She truly is. She has a bit of liquidity to her, thus the name Inque, and I think that plays even more so into the powers that we see and how they chose to manifest them in multiple appearances. Also, according to the DCAU wiki, she is the only Batman Beyond Rogue to appear 4 different times during the series, so we have multiple different appearances to discuss here. And in each episode that we've covered thus far, Blackout, Disappearing Inque, and Inkling, there's also a different sort of personification of the character. And you know, in the first issue, she's this hired, or in the first episode, she's a hired assassin we'll talk about. The second one, she's sort of, you know, manipulating this guy that worked where she was. And in the third one, it's an inner story about her and her daughter. So we get the different personas. They really fleshed out the character, and we learn a little bit more each and every time she appears on the show. So I think it's interesting, and I think it's very poetic that a character who is fluid and has so much depth to the character itself and character had so much dimension added through the storytelling in each of the episodes she appeared.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think there's that's something we've talked about a lot, is how, as you mentioned at the top of the show, how kind of underutilized, underexplored some of our Batman Beyond Rogues were. And with Inque, we get at least a little bit into her backstory, as you mentioned. But yes, things all kicked off on January 30th, 1999, with the it's technically the third episode, because Rebirth is 2 parts, but the third episode of Batman Beyond, an episode written by Robert Goodman and directed by friend of the show Dan Reba. Again, as you kind of mentioned, she's a sort of a hired gun doing a little corporate espionage at the behest of Derek Powers. That whole first season of Beyond is so focused on that, using Derek Powers as this sort of Norman Osborn, Lex Luthor type to be this ultimate foil for Terry, though he's not usually the one getting his hands dirty himself. And we see Inque immediately as a physical threat to Batman when it's sort of just business, but as Terry just keeps getting in the way, it ends up in a very personal final confrontation. And something that, one of those things where you're kind of surprised it happened this early in the series, which is, and honestly not really something other than, I guess you could say, Ra's al Ghul in the Demon's Quest. Aren't many villains who made it into the, and the Joker later on, there aren't many villains who made it into the Batcave. And here Inque is in her first appearance, hitching a ride, and Terry being still young in his career, perhaps not suspicious enough of her disappearing act, as she hitches a ride on the Batmobile back into the Batcave. And it's really Bruce and Terry together who have to take her down in a very memorable clash that takes place inside the Batcave.
That's right. Yeah, this is probably most memorable because of 2 very specific elements that occur. One, we get Bruce Wayne donning the Gray Ghost mask and hat in order to protect his identity from Inque, who, as you mentioned, had gained access via hitching a ride to the Batmobile. And number 2 is the very, very, very disturbing and nightmare-inducing visual of Inque, who has at this point overpowered both Bruce and Terry in the bat suit, of course, and she is going to fulfill her paid role, which is going to kill Batman, and she's going to do so by essentially drowning him, but by drowning him, she's not doing it with water. She's force feeding her liquid form into his mouth. And it's done in a way where you see what she's doing and then they cut away and you just kind of hear Terry gargling and, you see strategically placed shadows. And, I'm sure there were standards and practice rules and recuts for the episode, but it's done really, really well, as far as the, how they cut around that and the direction and the writing that both Mr. Goodman and Mr. Reba did for that episode. It is a disturbingly memorable moment in Batman Beyond. Everything that kind of crescendos at that moment, we'll talk about some of Ink's music later, but yeah, that's a unforgettable scene, and one that, as Terry, even after Bruce and him have figured out how to successfully defeat Ink, with Terry borrowing Mr. Freeze's old freeze gun to finally take her down. We get shots of Terry vomiting up parts of Ink. So just disturbing all the way around, and very fitting. And honestly, early on in the series, really set that dark tone for what that season one would be. A very memorable debut from Ink.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that that first episode is really spectacular. The really strong first season, and maybe when we're done the whole series, we'll do some sort of retrospective on each season or something. And that first season, this really came out of the gate strong.
Yeah, absolutely. It was it's a different tone. I think we've talked about this several times, is that there was sort of a mandate from WB that they wanted it to be more like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and more, you know, teen action once the season two kicked off, and less away from the corporate espionage and the archetype overlord pulling the strings behind the scenes once Blight was taken care of. So yeah, with that, but that first scene is both visually and topically dark in a lot of ways, and Ink fits right into that. Hey, Ink is dark in most cases. So it makes sense that she fits right in with that theme.
Absolutely. So we then next pick up the trail after we see the end of Blackout ends with the new Batman dropping off the frozen Ink in front of Commissioner Barbara Gordon, also her introduction to that series. But we again pick her up. She's been frozen and she's moved over to Gotham Cryogenics in the episode Disappearing Ink, which was written by Stan Berkowitz and directed by Kurt Gaeta. She's sort of being held in this ice block, and we have this sort of perennial loser character who's working at the lab called Aaron Herbst, who's just sort of complaining about his life and talking incessantly to Ink as if she can hear him, and as it turns out, she can, though she's none too happy about it. But he goes so far as to kiss the block of ice that she is. This guy's weird.
He's a retroactive Easter egg for what one might describe as incel behavior, or maybe simp behavior these days.
A little bit, yeah, a little bit of both. And we quickly find out he gets fired because, you know, in the in 50 years from now, whenever now is, they still have security cameras.
And kissing, security cameras are present, and kissing the ice is frowned upon, according to making passes at the frozen villains that don't have the ability to consent is not something that that the Gotham Cryogenics is too pleased with.
That's right. So at that point there, the disgruntled and now fired Aaron decides he's going to get one over on his former boss, and disables the power to Ink's cell, allowing the ice to thaw. She escapes, but she's still very weak. And so she actually goes and finds Aaron and tasks him with helping her get back to full strength. They're going to steal some vague chemicals that are going to help her get back to full strength. And it's not just a return to a life of crime Ink is wanting this time. She also wants revenge on not just Batman, not just Terry, but on Bruce as well. And after they're able to defeat Terry, after Ink's able to defeat Terry, she begins to return to full strength and captures him. she is able to lure Bruce out. She hears Batman talking to him on the radio, lures him out of hiding, and it leads to Bruce approaching this address that Ink gives them, where they're all holed up. And it leads to maybe again another hugely memorable moment for the whole series, and certainly for this first season, as Bruce puts on one last bat suit to try to free Terry from his captor.
Yeah, each of these Ink stories has a pretty epic moment. Two of them just happen to involve Bruce getting involved with a fight, and we get mm-hmm. the one and only appearance of the Bat Mech suit for this. It's very much inspired, I believe, by the Alex Ross Kingdom Come Batman suit. Mm-hmm. It's awesome. It's an awesome sequence. It's all too short. Because I think the point of the episode is to once again reinforce why Bruce is no longer Batman. Like if he was able to successfully fight this villain and defeat her in this suit, then it wouldn't make any sense why he couldn't just be Batman. So unfortunately, it is a short lived battle, and he's quickly overtaken by Ink. In this old Gotham arena that they're doing battle in. But it is awesome to see. And ultimately, Terry, Batman, is once again able to outsmart Ink, as she unfortunately decided to have this battle occur in a building with a all-glass roof, as Terry shoots some batarangs through the roof, breaking it, and the rain begins to pour down, leaking. And that's Ink's one main nemesis, is water. We learned that very early on. She's not a fan of water in any form, whether it be frozen or in its liquid form. She's not a fan. So the rain causes her to melt, and very much like the is it the Wicked Witch of the West in Wizard of Oz,
yeah,
that she melts. Yep. I think it's a wink and a nod to another Warner Brothers property there with her melting like the Wicked Witch there. And that seems to be the end, but we see her, I believe, go into a storm drain. So we are not sure whether or not this is the last that we've seen of her or not. But as we've already mentioned at the top, there's multiple appearances left, both in this show and in another DCAU show. So we know that she will live to fight another day. There is a somewhat horrifying resolution, as we learned that the obsessed Aaron, who is so obsessed that he also wanted to be turned into an Ink-like creature, has to suffer the same fate that Ink was suffering, as he now has someone that speaks to him in his deformed state and spends all her time sort of obsessing and sharing her life with him. So it's a poetic ending to a man who was responsible for breaking Ink out, and ultimately the deal with the devil was never worth it, of course.
Yeah, it's a real like Twilight Zone ending, I feel like, where mm-hmm. you know, careful what you wish for, and you know, the tables have turned by the end. But yeah, it's a really fun episode for that reason, and for historical purposes, as we talked about when we originally reviewed that episode, it's the episode that for a time as a child got me banned from watching Batman Beyond.
That moment is terrifying.
I would say when Ink gives him like the partial treatment to turn him in, and he becomes the super, he gets this like one giant eye and his face is drooping and one giant ear. And then there's a moment where when Bruce is first walking into the old abandoned arena, where he sees him in this deformed form, for lack of a better term, and he sort of reaches out to Bruce and tries to speak to him, and it's pretty horrific. But yeah, it was especially horrific for 6-year-old Liam, who was then banned from Batman Beyond for a couple of years afterwards. So this episode is it's one that is it always sticks out to me, and I feel like I watched it extra amount of times when the DVD came out, mm-hmm. as like a little bit of teenage rebellion of even though by then no one cared what I watched or didn't watch, but in my mind I had to make up for lost time by watching this episode a few extra times. So definitely an episode that was legendary in our house for multiple reasons as well. And then from there, we have Ink's last sort of main appearance a little bit later on. This is all the way into the third season, originally airing on September 30th, 2000, in an episode written by Hilary Bader and directed by Butch Lukic. Yeah, this is a long layoff of appearances, but we do see her back. There's a launch of a space station. She is she's working to try to destroy a rocket. She's back on her sort of mercenary ways, and after she has a another fight with Batman, it's clear that she's not up to fighting shape exactly. And we quickly find out that her last couple of battles with Batman have left her body sort of degenerating. This formula that gave her her power also comes at a cost, as she's no longer sort of being able to hold her solid form at all. And she's Clayface in mudsliding, if you will.
Precisely.
So she goes and tries to find help. And who does she seek after not only being defeated by Batman, but also being double crossed by this billionaire that she was working with to sabotage the rocket? She goes and finds, as it turns out, her daughter. And yeah, this is, as you mentioned, Cal, where we actually get to learn a little bit more about Ink. That she was a young mother. I don't think they say teenage. They probably couldn't for BSNP reasons say that she was a teenage mother. But they say she was a young mother. She didn't have any money, and so she gave up her child as a young lady. And we see Ink's daughter as this sort of overextended. She's getting her car repoed when we first meet her, and she's desperate for money. And so Ink and her daughter seem to be sort of bonding through this mutual need of each other suddenly, even though they've never had a relationship before. They don't really remember each other past when she was a very little girl. But her daughter needs money, and Ink needs help to steal some of these chemicals that are going to get her back to where she was. And that's where there is the conflict, of course, with Batman. And seemingly, Ink and her daughter are working very well together. Diana, her daughter, as well, and they've seemingly got her back to full strength just as Batman tracks them down. There's no Bruce this time, not even on the radio. Terry is sort of forced to try to fight her on his own. No Mr. Freeze gun either. He is seemingly very overmatched. Ink seemingly has him dead to rights, but right when it seems like she's going to win and off the Batman for good, her body once again begins to break down, and we find out that it's a bit of a double cross here by none other than Diana. Ink's daughter herself has taken her own steps, and believe it or not, it's all about the money.
Hey, to coin a phrase, I would say, yeah, she, it turns out that, being an absentee parent and then, coming back and, expecting your child to show love to you and not just simply, see dollar signs is not all that smart. And, in this case, by the way, Deanna's last name is Clay. How did we not point that out on the episode? I don't remember making that point out, but, Ink and Clay. But yeah, Diana, not too happy that her mom decided to give her up and put her through this. And, as you mentioned, she really only sees her mom as a paycheck. She does what she has to in order to take advantage of her mom. And just as it seems like, Ink is about to put an end to Terry, she begins breaking down, and, these horrific looking, boils begin appearing and popping on her, and she begins kind of like imploding and melting from the inside. And as she looks at her daughter, she realizes that she's been betrayed, and she asks her the purpose for this, why she was doing that. But Deanna says that she'd rather have the money than a parent, after all, because she lived all those years without her mom. So what's the difference now if she can have the money? So it seems at this point that this may be the last that we see of Ink, as she sort of bursts burns into this pile of goo. Again, I would say we probably learned from the last time that that's not a not necessarily the nail in the final coffin or the final nail in the coffin for this character. Melting away doesn't mean they're gone forever. And Terry or Batman begins to point that out to Deanna, that she's going to have to continue living a life looking over her shoulder. And we get sort of a, we talked about this when we reviewed the episode, whether it's actually it's supposed to be visually poetic, or whether or not it actually happened. But we get a kind of a postscript scene with Deanna living the high life now with all of her mom's ill-gotten gains. This plant behind her sort of begins to move and form. And it appears to be that Ink has come back to seek revenge. But the episode fades to black before giving a definitive answer as to whether or not that's what, if it's actually Ink or if it's just Deanna's mind playing tricks on her. So, it's interesting. You bring in this character, and it appears to be that she, you do get more of the backstory. You add more dimension to the character, explain why she is who she is. But you also get the reinforced, somewhat cliched, no honor amongst thieves, right? We see that Deanna is just as ruthless as her mother is. The apple doesn't far fall from the tree. Without her mom being in her life, she became as ruthless as as her mom was, and was willing to put her own wants and needs ahead of perhaps assisting her mom. So she did the right thing by obviously taking out her mom so that her mom couldn't kill Batman. But at the same time, it was definitely for the worst reason possible, simply for personal gain and stealing this money that was also likely stolen from somebody else. So, it's a weird episode that doesn't really give you the happy feels at the end. It's also kind of leaves you like, yeah, she kind of deserves to get hunted down by her mom at this point, but we don't really get a resolution to that story and a clear and defined answer as to whether or not that ever happens. But headcanon says Deanna didn't live off of that money very long.
That certainly feels like the implication. It's a very sort of horror movie ending to that episode, with the shadows in the bushes sort of transforming slowly into the angry eye of Ink. Great visual to end that episode. But that is, as mentioned, that's Ink's last full appearance, though she does have a couple of other minor ones, that being just a couple of episodes later on November 11th, 2000, in an episode written by Stan Berkowitz, Paul Dini, and Alan Burnett, and directed by Butch Lukic, that being The Call, Part 1. Now, this is an episode that's obviously very legendary. It introduces, it's in real world timeline wise, this is our first look at a DCAU Justice League. It's a big deal. We see Ink briefly at the beginning as she's on the run from Batman, and she decides to take a hostage, a civilian walking by, as to try to get Batman to back off. But it turns out that that particular hostage is faster than a speeding bullet, and takes care of her quite quickly, as we get the reveal of Superman into the world of Batman Beyond, or into the timeline of Batman Beyond, as you always correct me. Mm-hmm. Just a minor appearance, but it is a fun little bit there with her interacting with another character. She is also mentioned in the episode Countdown. And then her final appearance in timeline and in show-wise actually comes in a sequence that I think probably didn't actually happen within the context of the episode. I mean, none of it actually happened, but you know what I mean.
Right.
They're in the episode epilogue, which we have also not covered, as we've talked about. That'll likely be the final episode we ever do. But Terry is sort of having these visions of what he's going to do with his life now that he's discovered this completely unbelievable bomb has been dropped on his life about who he thought he was, who he thought his allies were. And he sort of envisions himself breaking things off with the Justice League that he was once a part of, including and in that sequence, we see Ink along with some of the other Batman Beyond rogues and a new look at the Parasite, all fighting the Justice League, and Batman swoops in to save the day before announcing he quits. So it's a very quick sequence, but it is fun to see those Beyond characters back and all that. But that does it for Ink's on-screen appearances. However, thankfully, she does have a couple of tie-in appearances and merchandise to talk about. First, we'll do her tie-in comics. This is a confusing way, but hopefully this makes sense. She appears in Batman Beyond, the 1999 miniseries, number 6, the very last issue of that series, once again sort of sees her tasked more as a mercenary helping a scientist. And then, of course, there's a double cross and she and Batman end up kind of working together. That one, the issue itself is you know, pretty solid story. But I think what really stands out is that cover to Batman Beyond 1999 miniseries number 6 of 6 is there's a tremendous cover that's drawn by James Tucker, Bruce Timm, and with colors by Lee Loridge, of Batman being all tangled up in ink's web, if you will. That's a really iconic comic book cover to me.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like that whole series has such great covers. That whole mini series has some really, really incredible artwork and covers done by some really big names there. So, but yeah, that he's kind of in the middle of the comic, and it's this stark white background with ink kind of stretched in different areas or kind of crisscrossing across the cover, and he looks in quite a bit of agony based on the expression on his face on the cover there. But yeah, that's one of those covers that will probably stick with me for a very long time as far as the artwork there. Like I said, though, all those miniseries covers are really, really strong.
Absolutely. And then she would later appear in Batman Beyond, also from 1999, but the ongoing series. They did a 6-issue miniseries and then immediately followed it with an ongoing series. I don't know why they did it that way, but that's what they did.
You think they were testing? I'm curious if it was like a sales test, if they didn't know if maybe the show itself, they didn't know if it was going to be a hit or not on the on the kids WB. So you do a mini series, and then if the show only lasts one season, then you know you don't have to cancel a comic book congruently. So maybe that was I'm gonna say that's my uneducated guess of what was going on.
Yeah, it might be something we've sort of Twitter friendly, Instagram friendly with Craig Rousseau, who did a lot of the art on those books. Might be something we can posit to him in the future and maybe get an update for you the next time we do one of these characters.
Yeah, that'd be good.
But yeah, those tie-in comics, we always talk about them. A lot of them were written by, some of them were written by Paul Dini. A lot of these Beyond issues are written by Hilary Bader. A lot of people who worked on the show also worked on this. We already talked about, you know, James Tucker and Bruce Timm. Eventually Darwin Cook did a bunch of the covers. There's a lot of the people that worked on the show's fingerprints. I would say almost more so on this Beyond series of tie-ins than maybe any of the others. I mean, obviously Paul wrote a couple issues of Batman Adventures and Batman and Robin Adventures, as we've talked about, but this Beyond series really had, I feel like, a little bit more of the fingerprints of the people working on the show at the same time as well. As it really, and it feels like maybe these are episodes that could, you know, or issues that could have been episodes, perhaps. And certainly that's the case in Batman Beyond ongoing 1999 number 2. That one also introduces kind of like a new power for Ink, where she's kind of able to sort of wrap herself around someone's butt. That sounds dirty. She's able to sort of take over someone's body by, you know, wrapping herself around the body, and sort of creates like these ninja suits that she puts people in and goes on a crime spree. So it's not exactly clear that it's her actually pulling the strings right away. So it kind of creates some interesting new ink lore that we never got to really see on screen. But that wraps it up for the tie-in comics. She did also appear in she has appeared in some of the more mainline DC Comics Batman Beyond series. Not as a, doesn't really get any major play, but does show up quite a few times along with most of the other legendary Batman Beyond rogues. But thankfully for us, for these character spotlight episodes, she is one of the few Batman Beyond villains who got toys.
One of the few, the proud. Yeah, we've talked about that, how that original run that Hasbro did with the action figures, a ton of Batman, like in an era where multicolored Batman on a shelf for a kid to buy was like the standard, as everyone kind of has made fun of and has become a joke now. Like, you know, multicolored Batman, you know, there's an orange Batman, a blue Batman, a red Batman, a green Batman. Like, they all have different gimmicks with them. Firefighting Batman, skydiving Batman, ninja Batman. Like, they all had different varying reasons why he was in a different suit. Batman Beyond, I feel like, was that to like the billionth level, because Batman Beyond himself is a really cool looking design, right? Stark black suit, giant red bat on his chest. He can fly. He's got these red wings on his back. He's a really, really fun looking character in his design. And all the toy executives said, nope, that's not cool enough. We need to add all of these different random colors and accessories and things to the sculpts. And we're going to go at it, but we're only going to make like three villains total for your Batman to fight. Otherwise, the Batman has to fight all the other Batmen, I guess.
That's pretty much it. That's pretty much all you got. Yeah, so we did have one ink. First, it's from the Burger King Kids Meal toy set. One of the few villains along with Blight that got a figure in that set.
It was color changing and also had a has a keychain or like a backpack hook attached to its head.
That part feels like a little bit overthinking.
As I was doing research for the stuff that we'll talk about later, something dawned on me that I think is a reason why some of those toys later on came like attached to a stand or stuff. And it's because I feel like maybe there was a licensing issue where a certain company had exclusive license, like we're given the exclusive license to make an action figure and with movable arms and legs, right? So if you're a Happy Meal, you can either make it like a statue that doesn't move, or it has to be glued down on a stand, or it has to have a hook coming out of its head. It can't be an action figure that would somehow, I guess, interfere with a kid wanting the one that's on the shelf. I feel like that's my uneducated, somewhat knowledgeable brain about how.
That's as good as a reason as I've ever heard, and I hadn't really thought about it that way. But that does make sense, because even the Batman figures are like, there's like a talking one that's on a weird little stand that he's kind of sitting on, and there's a Batman with like retractable wings that go up and down, but is also on a weird stand, and then there's the Blight. Blight's on us. Everybody's on a stand in that set, except for Ink, who's this weird little keychain thing. So,
and the Batmobile that is just a Batmobile.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that one has like a little launcher thing that you can speed it away on. But back to Ink here. She, as you mentioned, a color change. You could change it in like warm and cold water. She would have a more human looking face, and then you could turn it to more like the bluish grayish color that it was on the actual show. I like that one of her arms is kind of turned into like a big like swirly hook. For a Happy Meal toy, it's a pretty good shout at a pretty good stab at making an Ink figure for the show. And as we've talked about, an issue that has plagued these lines for years, whether they're Happy Meal or main retail toys, it's really hard to get female figures made in these animated series lines. Whether true or not, there was a belief that they just wouldn't sell, or that, you know, if a boy got that toy, he'd be mad. So there just weren't many. So it's kind of fun when they do pop up in these early sets, even as a Happy Meal toy. I think it's pretty good. And then, a couple of decades later, we finally got another Ink. Well, sort of, thanks to the McFarlane Batman Beyond lines. This is a pretty now classic expected McFarlane repaint to get a third or fourth version of the same figure back onto shelves for rather than just re-releasing the same toy over and over. They do, I guess, at least try to give some value to for collectors. by doing a little repainting. And so we got a re-release of the McFarlane Batman Beyond 6-inch figure. But this time it's painted to look like ink, and it is officially, it's a different figure. If you're a mint on card collector, I imagine this was pretty frustrating for you, because this figure is officially named Ink disguised as Batman. So this is technically Ink's second ever figure. It's the McFarlane Batman Beyond figure, but it has the blue bat. And I will give some credit to the paint app on that figure. They do, if you look at her, if you look at the figure on the side, they do have that sort of blue and black marbling look on the arms and legs of the figure. So they didn't just paint the bat blue and call it a day, which I think is what I thought happened when I first saw this figure on a store shelf. But if nobody else made an effort on this, the people doing the paint app certainly did. But it's a fun little nifty way, like we said, to just get this Batman Beyond figure back on shelves in a way that isn't just a straight re-release, I guess.
Yeah, I think she deserves better, obviously. Okay. But sure, yeah, it's Todd knows his audience. He knows that the complete collector is going to like pull their hair out knowing that they now have to get a blue Batman Beyond simply because it's listed as a different character, even though it doesn't make a whole ton of sense. But yeah,
it does represent a moment technically from the show, even though the figure is more based on a more recent comic book version of Batman Beyond, because in the Disappearing Ink episode, she does transform herself into a shadowy version of Terry to try to trick Bruce at one point. So it technically does represent a moment, but that's not, I don't think Todd knew that.
Right.
I think they said, let's just do a repaint of this. And then somebody who maybe cared a little bit about the show's continuity is like, well, there's an episode where Ink is. So the wings are blue, the bat is blue, and the paint has that blue and black marbling. But yeah, a real actual Ink figure. We got a really great Shriek figure out of McFarlane. You know, a couple good Batman and Batwoman Beyond figures from some of the comics. A really cool Blight, though I wish, obviously, as most people do, that it was based more on his animated appearance than his comic book one. But yeah, it would have been nice to get an actual Ink figure, and maybe fingers crossed down the line someday we will. But for now, this is all we got.
That's right. Yeah, we'll see. Todd has access to all these DC collectible sculpts, so there were rumors of a Superman set that I don't know how far along it ever got to, but there was Paul Dini quoted saying there were Superman figures. Obviously, they made a Batman Beyond set, so who knows? Maybe there's some sculpts out there or things that have yet to see the light of day. But hey, if Mondo continues down their path, I think that at one point they talked having a Batman Beyond man in Ink. An Ink like Mondo figure would be like mind blowing. Would be super cool. But hey, that's 50 years from now. Whenever now is likely, based on how quickly they're going through the Batman animated series figures.
Right. And wrapping up here, we just have a few more notes on Ink before moving on. One will be her voice actor. We have Shannon Kenny as the voice of Ink in all four of her episode appearances in Batman Beyond. I don't think she speaks in the Justice League episode, but. Shannon Kenny, I really like her as Ink. They kind of put a little effect on her voice, especially when she's in the gooey form where she just, instead of the face, she has just like the one big eye. Mm-hmm. They kind of put an effect on her voice, and depending on sort of the state she's in when she's sort of melting, they added some pretty cool sound effects. So this is like a testament not only to Miss Kenny's performance, but I think she does a really good job versus sort of the kind of cold, calculating mercenary, and then being sort of more revenge focused in her future episodes. But also this is kind of a triumph of like sound engineering, I think, as far as what they're able to pull off with her and her different forms, and then her when the rain is coming down and she's melting away, or when the chemical compound starts exploding in her body and she's bubbling and everything in the last episode. They do some creative stuff sound wise as well with Miss Kenny's voice performances.
Yeah, I think she's great too. I think she obviously goes toe to toe with Terry quite a bit, but she has a lot of interaction with Derek Powers in that very first episode. You know, where they're that scene with them in the office, and you know, she's kind of revealed as the person, this hired assassin that's out to kill Batman, is certainly very interesting. And well, not to kill Batman, but to also take care of the Wayne Powers rival company, Fox Teca, Lucius Fox's son's company. But yeah, we get, I think her performance is great. To your point, yes, I love the voice effect that differentiates from when she changes to her more human looking form to the inky blobby white dot face version of the character. It's great. She has a lot of like horrific screams that she has to do, whether it's when she's melting or being electrocuted at different points, or when she gets frozen, when she gets the mutagen finally kicks in and begins to destroy her from the inside out. She has a range of emotion in that last episode too, where she's trying to kind of connect with this daughter while she's also sick. So she has to put that on. And then she's trying to connect with her and trying to have this emotional connection with somebody that she hasn't had a relationship with for her entire life, pretty much. And then that expressing of feeling betrayed at the end and questioning her, thinking that their blood must make them, you know, would make this person loyal to her. There's some great dialogue and back and forth there, and the way that she does her lines. So mm-hmm. Yes, she's excellent in all the three of the episodes that we've covered thus far, and in her appearances. And unshockingly a great choice in casting her as the voice of this character.
Absolutely. Yeah, great job by Miss Andrea Romano, of course, and great job by Shannon Kenny doing the voice. And like I said, a character that really gets to evolve over her appearances, which is pretty cool. And before we wrap it up, our last thing we will just touch on is music. There isn't really, I would say, a definitive Ink theme, but thankfully the full soundtrack for two of her appearances is now available, as finally someone got their head out of their tuchus and finally released at least one volume of the original soundtrack for Batman Beyond. We have all of the tracks in their full entirety released now as a compilation on all of the major music platforms. All of the great music by Christopher Carter, Michael McQuestion, Lolita Ritmanis, and Shirley Walker available from that first season. And so we get all of the tracks. We listen back to the tracks for Blackout and for Disappearing Ink. And there's not really like as we talk about with a lot of the Beyond characters, there's not really like a hummable theme for Ink, but there's a certain sort of drive. Her music, her episodes, especially her action sequences, very guitar driven to me. It's very fast paced, and it's very it's very synth and guitar driven in her action beats. Each episode kind of has its own recurring refrain that you'll hear throughout the action, but I wouldn't necessarily say either one qualifies for a main Ink theme. But Christopher Carter responsible for the music for both of those first two appearances, and yeah, it just feels like there's a really frenetic, fast-paced, guitar-driven music whenever Ink's around, and then maybe some sort of softer, eerie, synthy stuff going on when she's in when she's not attacking, I guess.
Yeah, most of the pieces that are available in that soundtrack, which I want to say, based on the fact that the Dynamic Music Partners were promoting that themselves, they may have self-released that. I don't know how they would have gotten the license, or maybe they licensed it through Warner Brothers, but either way, thank you to whoever decided to let them to release that soundtrack, because it really does help when you're trying to listen to pieces, especially with Batman Beyond, because as we've talked about, there's less I think there's less, because of the action and because the pieces for a lot of the series are so percussion heavy, it's sometimes hard if you're watching the episode to differentiate between the different pieces, or other than like slight elements or things that are used differently. But yeah, it's a huge advantage to be able to listen to individual pieces. So happy about that. But yeah, that the each of the Ink pieces sort of starts with this sort of ethereal, horror movie haunting sort of keys that are just kind of blaring in one single note, but done so in this very haunting, like gives you this uneasy feeling when it starts off. And each of the pieces that I listen to kind of starts with that, and then eventually it kicks in with the percussion or the, you know, whatever else is, you know, whatever the refrain is that's used. But yeah, they're impressive pieces, obviously, as most of the music, if not all of the music, is for this series. So it's great to be able to hear those. But the thing that comes back to each piece, as you mentioned, is there is a driving guitar and drum combo of a similar refrain. My personal favorite, I love the one that was used for the first episode, but then you also have these moments of sort of pause there's a downbeat and this haunting sort of pause that occurs while that gives you this, it almost sounds like choral, just like haunting voices just hanging on one single note, and then the rest of the guitar and the drums will kick back in later. But yeah, really, really great pieces, really memorable, and obviously, as is most of the pieces that Mr. Carter was responsible for. So yeah, unsurprising that we were both big fans. But hey, what a difference being able to hear the pieces in isolation makes, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like, I mean, again, like you said, if we had to sort of parse this out just listening to clips from the episode, it would be really hard to be like, well, there's definitely drums playing. Like we talked about tempo more, I think, than the actual music itself a lot of the times. And it's when we don't have access to the music by itself. So definitely a great asset for us and for all DCAO fans to have that first volume of the soundtrack, and hopefully we'll be getting the next couple of volumes soon. So really appreciate that. And moving on to our second character of this dual character spotlight, we of course had the introduction of the assassin Curare. This character I believe was the original design, I believe was done by Glenn Murakami. And certainly it was his vision for this character to be certainly a recurring villain, and also maybe even, as has been talked about by James Tucker, maybe something of a love interest, more akin to like an Elektra type of character, for Terry to sort of clash with, because of their different methods, their different codes of honor. But that was sort of undone inadvertently by James Tucker, who was storyboarding that the first episode. And of course there's the moment where Kirari's headdress, what would you call that, a mask, a headdress?
It's
a hijab.
Hijab. Yep, that's right. Yeah. I think that's what it is, with a face covering. Yeah.
So, yeah. With that face covering, at one point the mask does remove, and we see that she is somewhat disfigured and also hairless. So that was actually a storyboarding decision by James Tucker, obviously approved by the people working on the show, but that did sort of dash the idea for her to be a recurring romantic foil for Terry. But it does create a very memorable character design. Again, she, as mentioned, she's mostly covered up by this white outfit that she's in. She's from the Society of Assassins, but she also has blue skin for reasons that are never really made clear.
Yep.
But she does in fact have blue skin, and she is she's just this ultimate assassin with their sword, and again is a different sort of physical match for Batman, for this tech advanced Batman. It's a really interesting foil. She has this ultra sharp sword that can seemingly cut through anything. We see her cut through like rock and metal and all of these things. She's this ultimate foil for Terry. But we see her first appearance come in an episode aptly titled A Touch of Curare, where she is a hired assassin sent by this Society of Assassins, and she is sent to kill Sam, the district attorney, and happens to be Barbara Gordon's husband. And this episode really ends up being a bit more of a backup. Curare kind of plays second fiddle. She's the main foe, of course, but it's really a story of Barbara explaining to Terry both when he is in and out of costume, why she is so hesitant to accept a Batman returning to the streets or skies of Gotham after Bruce, and how she sort of how she views the costumed vigilantes compared to when she was once Batgirl, although by the end of that episode, certainly they come to an understanding. So it's really an episode that focuses on Terry and Barbara and Bruce more than it focuses on Curare herself. But they do definitely establish very quickly that she's unstoppable and there's nobody except. And that's sort of, I guess, how we get to our resolution and our respect, is that there's no cop that can stop a threat like Curare. You really kind of need the kid in the bat suit for this one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that clearly that was the motivation of this. We have the tension that's going to be set up here between Barbara and Bruce, and you know, you have to have Terry operating as a vigilante, and rather than having the friendly relationship, obviously, that Bruce had with Jim Gordon, you're going to have the opposite here with a commissioner who is ironically a former vigilante herself, but is going to be at odds with the idea of having a vigilante running around in Gotham City. So she obviously kind of learns her lesson, as you mentioned, and comes to grips with it at the end. The things I think that we learn mostly about Curare for this episode is that she's a member of the Society of Assassins. And we learn that she's not only a member of it, but a sort of a vicious member. I'd like to think that maybe the blue skin is something like an initiation for them or something. Like maybe they all dye their skin, or, you know, it's 50 years from now, whenever now is. That could be a body tattoo or something like that. But she carries this gigantic, as you mentioned, incredibly sharp scimitar around that slices through all this stuff. And by the end of it, because Terry is the first one to successfully prevent her from completing her job and killing her target in Sam, this means that she's sort of brought dishonor to the Society of Assassins. And what happens when you do that is that the assassins go from attempting to kill whoever their target was to turning on that member themselves. So she becomes a target of the Society of the Assassins, because we learn that as Bruce is quite knowledgeable, that's what happens. You fail, you die. So because Curare has failed now, she has and had previously never failed before, she is now facing the wrath, or the full wrath, of the Society of Assassins, as the episode ends with Curare making an escape from Batman. But as she's escaping, we see a sword break through the roof of the vehicle that she's driving, sort of noting that she's under attack from the rest of the assassins. So it's kind of left with a bit of a cliffhanger there. You're left to think that maybe she might have died. But as you mentioned, she's got two appearances in this series. So we know that, in fact, that was not her final appearance for the show.
In a season two episode, this episode airing on February 5th, 2000, in an episode written by Hilary Bader and Alan Burnett and directed by Butch Lukic, called Final Cut. And this episode actually kind of directly follows up on that one in a way. As we see, Bruce is out of town. Max, who has since discovered Terry's secret, is kind of really pushing to get more involved with his Batman activities, especially while Bruce isn't there to help him out. Terry's very resistant to that, but when this mysterious assassin comes into town, he makes quite an impression on Batman as he reveals that he's the last living member of this Society of Assassins that Curare was a part of. Because after the society turned on her, she killed all of them, which is pretty badass,
ruthless.
Yes, so she did not take her punishment lying down, to say the least, for failing to kill her target in the previous episode. So, and this assassin has made sort of a gambit with Batman. He's decided that he has a bomb somewhere in the city, and that if he doesn't key in a specific code every 12 hours, it'll explode. And so Batman now has a little extra incentive to keep Curare from killing this guy. As mentioned, this also involves Max sort of forcing her way into the story and getting into the assassins. She's looking over the assassin's apartment while Terry is meeting with him in the park, which leads Max face to face with Curare in a pretty memorable scene. Again, right out of a horror movie. I think there's definitely a Shining bit in that episode where she's closes the bathroom door and then the sword comes bursting through.
Psycho, and, right?
It's The Shining, right? It's Here's Johnny.
I thought, I'm thinking of Psycho, where she's in the shower and
it might be both.
and like the kit, you just see the Hitchcock. It's black and white, mm-hmm. and you just see the blood rushing into the drain. Either way, it's a horror movie that I haven't seen.
Yeah, I think the sword through the door is definitely The Shining, but I think you're right. There's probably a little Psycho homage there as well. And yeah, it does set up this final battle between Terry as unfortunately Chiari does get to this assassin and vaguely doesn't kill him, but gives it. There's some sort of poison that wipes his brain because we can't say that the assassin killed somebody on our children's Saturday morning cartoon.
Sure.
But unfortunately, since he is now brain dead or whatever, he is unable to input this code to disarm the bomb. And so Terry and Max and Curare have this one final battle in a really cool set piece episode as they're in this like a museum with all these old World War One and Two planes that are hanging from the ceiling. And Terry and Curare are doing battle up above as pieces of these displays are falling down and Max is dodging debris and trying to disarm this bomb at the same time. It's a very tense final standoff, although of course ultimately our heroes prevail and Curare lives to fight another day, though that would end up being her last appearance on screen in the DCAU, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a sort of an unceremonious end. I will say that fight at the Gotham Museum of Armament is one of maybe the best, I would say. It's probably a top three in Batman Beyond and certainly worth talking about. I don't know how many different battles you could argue in the DCAU. So I won't go so far as to wax poetically about this being maybe a top 10 there, because that seems to be a list that would take hours to decipher. But it's a lot of fun. The action that takes place is ridiculous as they're jumping from these different hanging disarmed bombs and planes and all of the stuff that are hanging on this from the ceiling. There's, I believe, even a little bit of CGI that was used, like early cel shaded CGI from this era. That's done as you get this some really beautiful choreography and animation that's done for this for that final sequence. But very memorable. And yeah, it's a bit of a downer to say she doesn't come back. Like, we don't get another appearance from her because she is such an interesting looking character. The idea that her one weapon is just this incredibly powerful scimitar, but she's obviously, and shows in this episode and in the first episode, she's incredibly athletic. It's not implied that she's like genetically enhanced or anything like that. I don't think she exhibits anything that would say that she has super strength, but she certainly jumps higher and further than a lot of characters you would think normally would. So maybe there's something else there. I don't know. It adds to the mystery, though. It leaves you wanting to know more about this character, her past, who she was and how she came to be and all this stuff. Like that kind of leaves you with wanting more of that. And unfortunately we didn't get much more.
Yeah, that's true. Would have been fun to see another episode where we learn more about her, but that case was not to be yet. Just a fun character, as we'll talk about in a second here. As you mentioned, she does not speak, which is also, I think, sets her out as far as a very unique character to have your main villain be someone who doesn't talk. She does have some grunts and groans, which are attributed to the actress Melissa Disney. Yes, she is related to the Disney family loosely. But there's not really she doesn't speak. And so I think just finding out any more about why, because obviously we meet another member of the society. He isn't blue. He's not wearing any sort of like, you know, headdress or any sort of like official adornments. He's dressed like any other guy on the streets of Gotham, seemingly. and he's using guns, like he doesn't use a sword. So it seems like the assassin, this society of assassins she was a part of, was a pretty eclectic group. It would have been fun to see perhaps more more characters from that that world show up in future episodes, but alas, it was not to be here. We'll mention here, we'll get briefly, really, we just got music and one tie-in comic to talk about. That is Batman Beyond 1999 ongoing number 9, where she actually does, and speaking of what we were just talking about, where we see she starts her own assassin's cult following the events of these two episodes. She's got her own apprentice with her own unique weapons. They are all wearing sort of a uniform headdress look to sort of pay homage to her. And it sort of comes to an end with a final confrontation where Batman is once again able to defeat her. And her followers take the sword back and promise that it'll be waiting for her when she comes back. So again, another interesting development that you kind of wish you could have seen on screen, where we see her cast more as the role of a hero, and or as not a hero, but a leader and a person with legions of followers herself. Could have been a really interesting thing, and sort of a role. We didn't really have a Ra's al Ghul-esque character in the Beyond world. I guess Cobra kind of fills that role eventually, but not really. Not
yeah,
in a cool way. So yeah, I kind of wish you could have seen more of that that side of her as well. But as mentioned,
how cool would have been, yeah, for her to be like a leader of a, like, she's intimated that she's the best of that secret society of assassins, but like it would have been cool to see her like lead that army, or lead an army, or mm-hmm. you know, Batman yeah, have like, to go beyond, have to go international in order to stop mm-hmm. her, or something like that, as a sort of similar pathway as Bruce took with Ra's al Ghul.
Absolutely, yeah. And like I think the idea of like she's so good at killing people that one day she just got bored and it's like, I guess I'll start training people, because
right.
like, I gotta have somebody that maybe one day will try to kill me that'll actually be a threat. So I got to train those. I got to train these future people myself. So like, I think that could have been a really interesting angle to take with her. But yeah,
maybe
unfortunately,
even a follow up to not being able to kill Sam is like her, you know, she has to avenge that in some form or fashion. So there's even, you know, maybe she takes Barbara hostage or something mm-hmm. like that, you know, something that would involve Sam teaming up with Batman to sort of like, you know, if she came back for revenge for her one failure or something like that, something along those lines.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely think there was more meat on the bone left there. And then our last thing we will mention with Curare, of course, as we just did with the music, her first appearance, which is on that Volume 1 soundtrack, music done by Shirley Walker, the late Shirley Walker. Very, very percussion focused again. You use sort of more conga drums, and there's a, It's a really interesting, you kind of pointed this out, there is like a Middle Eastern, it's very sort of synthesizer, it almost feels like video game boss music in a lot of places, but there is sort of, it's like you're fighting, there's a little bit of like an Eastern Japanese, because she is kind of this ninja type character, but it's also more of like a Middle Eastern mm-hmm. style, there's like a little bit of that, so it's like, it's all kind of melded together, it feels like, If there was a Batman Beyond SNES game, this is exactly the music for the Curare boss fight that you would expect. Like, it's got this really fun sort of video gamey soundtrack quality to it, but it's all sort of focused on these Middle Eastern sounding synthesizers and these really sort of fast paced conga drums.
Yeah, it's certainly very interesting, really neat pieces and stuff that I don't think. The ink stuff was definitely more memorable to me, and this is definitely something that stood out and benefited from being able to hear these pieces in isolation. I would like to hear maybe the pieces from the second episode in isolation. Hopefully we get a further release of the rest of the soundtrack. Appreciate those, to hear if any of those refrains come back. But yeah, they're really, really neat pieces, and there's a couple of them from the episode, and that same refrain and style sort of returns there. So I love the melding of the different styles, and of course it all sounds like trademark Batman Beyond at the end of the day, but of course it has like the late great Miss Walker's own personal twist on it, and including some more traditional of the orchestral music or instrument selection with the heavy percussion and the grounding it still for the same series. So yeah, really, 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 really fun pieces.
Absolutely. And one last thing I mentioned, I think I forgot to mention this for that episode, but the original appearance, A Touch of Curare, original air date, May 15th, 1999, written by Hilary Bader and directed by Dan Rebus. So yeah, I think both of our characters, Ink a little less so because we at least got to learn a little bit about her backstory and saw her grow into a more formidable foe as the show went on. Curare, definitely a lot of meat on the bone, but I could have used probably at least 2-3 more episodes with both of these characters, I think it's safe to say.
Yeah, absolutely. They are fascinating, and I don't think that we fleshed out enough. They are unique, but similar enough, as we talked to, that they're not a one-in-one copy and paste of an existing character, but they have similarities that make it feel familiar to you. You know, we talked about whether it's maybe the ninja from Batman the Animated Series, also a mysterious figure that carries a sword around and you know, bests Batman or attempts to best Batman, an assassin type, or as you mentioned, Ra's al Ghul, who also had his own sword fighting with Batman, and Ink with the Clayface, or you know, whatever, any number of that that fearsome foe that is in liquid form, but they are unique enough in that they are their own creations of this series, that they don't just feel like copy and paste or those villains beyond, which is what the series set out to do, is to create its own identity and its own villains. And these are certainly two worthy characters that deserved more than they got. But the things that we did get, I think that's a testament to how good the episodes, the action figures, the vocal performances, the music, all of that together combined to create two really interesting characters that we are left wanting more. It's better than, like, I would say, I don't know, the Sewer King, who we wished we didn't ever exist. So,
c'est la vie, as they say. But Cal, since, as you mentioned, we don't have any Curare toys,
she doesn't even get a hero click. Like, we
hero clicks. Oh, you I think we forgot to mention, but yes, Ink does also have a hero click in addition to her.
Yeah.
To her other choice.
So not even like a little statue, a bust, I found a Batman Beyond postcard. It did not have Curare in it. And it is interesting, we talked about this before we went on the air. I think there were very specific character designs in like the show Bible that were given out for promotional work and like to slap on t-shirts and some of the other ridiculous things that we'll talk about here. Something tells me, I don't know if it's because it's a masked female with a sword or what, it just, they decided that Curare and Ink were not in that show Bible. So they were not a part of the promotional material images. They weren't going on shirts or, or, you know, book bags, apparently.
Yeah. Gosh, even years later with like the DVD and Blu-ray releases, you're like, why is the golem, or the guy from the episode, the weird like turtle guy from the episode where from April Moon, like he's all over the box art and DVD art. And you're like, why? This character is in one episode for 5 seconds, but we don't. And it's just like exactly what you said. It was not in those stock promotional images that still get used when they roll out new box sets or new official Warner Brothers merchandise from the show for whatever reason. So but yes, since we don't have any Curare toys or hero clicks or statues or not even like a color, I don't even think she appeared in like a coloring book or anything. because of that, we wanted to have a little something to talk about when it comes to merchandise and so we decided we would go down sort of a wild, and this is really your baby, so I'm going to let you drive here, but sort of a wild eBay and Google rabbit hole as we discovered just some absolutely wild Batman Beyond themed merch, a lot of it coming from the now defunct Warner Brothers Studio store that existed in the 90s and into the early 2000s. But we found just some, or you found, I should say, just some absolutely fascinating gems in the world of weird Batman Beyond merch this week.
Yeah, and we're not going to go into like the, of course, there were t-shirts and I'm sure there were hats and things that we could go on for days. If you do a Google search, by the way, if you have one of those, they're probably worth a lot of money based on what I'm seeing, if they're good enough to resell on the secondary market. So check your closets or maybe your parents' attics to see if they still have your Batman Beyond merchandise from when you were a kid. But yeah, of course you had your standard things. Like, I'm sure there were Batman Beyond bed sheets and backpacks and shirts and stuff like that. But we really wanted to tackle some of the really unique items that I looked at and saw and said, who would ever buy that then? But now we're all, you and I are both like, wow, I need that. Like, that is so bizarre and so goofy. I want that as a part of my collection. So yeah, we scoured the depths of eBay and Google image search and those, some, even some international eBay knockoff sites to find some of the wackiest and most interesting Batman Beyond merchandise. So we'll kick things off with this very scary and terrifying looking Batman Beyond child's Halloween mask. And I put child's in air quotes because it looks much more like something that you would see at a adult entertainment store, is like a PG way of putting this. It is utterly terrifying. I sent this to you. It's got a built-in mouth, but the mouth has like this little square cut out of it, I guess. So that the child could breathe. But it also has like the white lenses over the eyes. It's definitely made of some sort of cheap latex. It's horrifying. It is absolutely horrifying. It doesn't look anything like Batman, the Beyond model. It looks like some creepy adult oriented item is all I'll say. Like, it just doesn't look right. It's available on eBay if you are an adult and you want to get one for yourself. It's there for you. But it was disturbing, to say the least. More disturbing than Ink force feeding herself to Terry to try and kill him, I'd say. Yeah, it was pretty weird.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where you go, oh, this is like, this would be on the banned list at like schools, and along with all like the scream masks that like bled and stuff, they would be banned from all like school Halloween parties and any state or church functions, costume parties. These would not be allowed for fear they were threatening to summon some sort of demon or devil to the party with this horrific Batman Beyond,
yes,
allegedly for children mask.
It's quite scary, but fear not if you're afraid of this mask or maybe the dark. The Warner Brothers Studio store, which we just talked about, it was at an actual, it was kind of like the Disney store that you still, I believe, find in malls, where they just had all kind of branded property stuff, stuffed animals and shirts and hats and all that stuff, all WB property. So that store was stocked heavily with Batman the Animated Series, Superman the Animated Series, Batman Beyond stuff, and that's where a lot of this stuff comes from. But if you were afraid of the dark, never fear. Warner Brothers Studio Store had an exclusive Batman nightlight that you could plug in to your outlet to light up the night. And this is actually kind of cool, other than the fact that it's like, it's just Batman's torso up. He's got his hands on his side. He's got the wings behind him. And for some inexplicable reason, even though the image that we have of the item is extremely pixelated, as I was only able to find one image of it, it appears that he's like stuck in some sort of either cloud or rock. I can't tell. Maybe it's like a piece of the Bat Cave, but he's like, it's torso up, and then it's just this weird thing that's he's appears to be frozen in the middle of. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it's supposed to represent. But hey, I'm sure it looks cool when you plug it in and the, you know, keeps you safe at night and made a kid happy and unafraid of the dark, hopefully.
I'd certainly feel better if I had it when I was going to sleep. But yeah, no, it's like he's doing like the real like Superman-y hands on hip pose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he's like a genie. It's like Batman Beyond is a genie. I don't know how to describe this. He's just appearing out of this puff of smoke or something. And and he's like, when you plug this in based on the way, maybe it twisted on the plug, but it looks like he'd be kind of sideways.
Yeah.
But depending on like where the outlet was in your room, you're probably not even seeing Batman, or maybe you're seeing like you're seeing like the shadow that the light casts of his silhouette or something. I don't know. It's an interesting design, to say the least. And we will, if we haven't mentioned, we'll be throwing up pictures of all of these. We've already thrown up a couple of teasers before the episode drops, but by the time you all are listening to this, these pictures will be up on our Twitters and Instagrams and stuff for you to watch along with us as we describe these.
Absolutely, yeah. The visually, you really need the visual to complete the ensemble here. But continuing with our strange items that were basically like I assume that they hoped that a kid would pick up in the store and run up and yell and cry and scream until their parent relented and bought them. We have the Batman Beyond Return of the Joker slap bracelet. It's actually I thought it was a slap bracelet. It's got snaps on it. I don't know. Again, it kind of looks like a choker or something that you would wear around your neck. It's allegedly a bracelet, but it's got the Joker's head on one side. It's got this logo in the middle and then Batman's head on the opposite side. So it's two floating heads. I was never a fan of the Batman Beyond Return of the Joker logo. It never made a whole bunch of sense to me. It always looked distorted and out of perspective and not really original. But you have this logo plastered in the middle of a blue bracelet. Who is this for? Who wore this? What? I guess it's like a 7-year-old wore this and thought they were cool as heck, I guess.
Yeah, I was like, was this thing, this bracelet, whatever material it's made out of, it must have just naturally been this like garish blue color, right? There's no reason.
Absolutely.
I don't want someone purposefully, other than for cost cutting purposes of not wanting to make it black or red, would have bothered painting this thing blue if it wasn't already this color. That's the only way. And then they tack on these what appear to be very lightly pasted on Joker and Batman heads, along with this weird little logo on it. It's a very odd looking piece.
Yeah. So when you wore it as an 8-year-old, when you wore your very cool Batman Beyond Return of the Joker bracelet to school, you could also around the Valentine holiday, bring your Batman Beyond Valentine's. And guess what? You had 2 years worth of different designs to use to give to your classmates, because we found a 40-pack and a 32-pack of Valentine's, Batman Beyond Valentine's. This was pretty common, right, back in the day. Oh, yeah. And so it's not really all that weird. But I will just say that this was something that I noticed on a lot of the merchandise, is that somebody somewhere decided that they had to explain that this Batman was cool and hip and young, and they decided to use what they thought was cool lingo to assign to this. So all of the Valentines have like some kind of weird tagline on them, and they're usually like pretty innocuous and they're designed to not be very mushy or gushy. But there's like a shot of Batman in the Batcave with pictures of all of the villains, including what looks like a TNBA Joker on the Bat computer, and it says, "Hope you're surrounded by friends on Valentine's Day." Okay,
this is something where it, like, if it was made in the modern era, you'd be like, these are AI.
Absolutely.
Someone generated a bunch of, said, write me a bunch of vaguely futuristic sounding Valentine card lines.
Yeah, there's a couple of them. Actually, they did put have an unbearably cool Valentine's Day, which I liked. That's obviously a line ripped right from the show. So that's kind of cool. But then there's this one that I just did not get. Hope your Valentine's Day jams.
Is that okay?
I would have gone with Happy Valentine's Shway.
Yeah, That one works.
I don't get the jams one, but anyway.
Yeah, I don't. Again, maybe a slang term that was lost to time. I like this other set where it's just like, hope you're the center of attention, and it's just a picture of Batman. Have a top notch Valentine's Day, and it's just the shot of Batman in front of the moon.
Yep. It doesn't make a lot of sense.
Have a blight free Valentine's Day, and it's just a picture of blight.
Hey, ink's on this one.
Oh, hey, there's a little bonus ink merch for you.
It says inkling of you.
Okay, it's
thinkling of you.
I think it's thinking, but it's spelled with the Q U E.
Oh,
like,
that's kind of weird.
Okay, that one's actually kind of clever. That's the only one of these so far that feels like there was a tiny bit of thought put into it.
All right, let's move away from these. Of course, we found a bunch of keychains. There's actually several very cool 3D keychains. One of them, however, I discovered, it says, Batman, new hero in town. Again, some marketing person was like, we have to describe that this Batman is different than the other Batman that's also on all the other merchandise. So how does this Batman, why not write Batman Beyond or Batman from the future or whatever? Nope. Batman, new hero in town. It's described on this 3D keychain. Very, very funny.
Batman is done. It's not in like Jap. It's sort of, it's English letters, but they're designed to look like they're Japanese characters or something like that. Or that's the font they went with. It's very interesting choice there.
It's definitely an Asian inspired font, to say the least. Liam, let me ask you this. When you're a kid, how did you listen to the radio?
Usually on a boom box.
I guess you never had your own version of the Batman Beyond FM ear receiver, which appears to be a single ear and antenna topped earpiece. It's kind of like one of those headphones that goes with the wrap behind your ear. I don't know if they still make those. It's like a single earbud, essentially, but it has this giant antenna that sticks up off of it and apparently runs on two like watch batteries. Guess you didn't have one of those when you were growing up.
Unfortunately not. Would have loved to have this. As preposterous as it looked, yeah, it's sort of got a bat ear, and then it is at least color coordinated in black and red, and then there's a little see-through portion of it where you can see the microchips in it and a little Batman Beyond logo printed onto that. So like they put a little effort in here to make it seem cool, but yeah, I can't imagine this was the hottest item on any kid's Christmas list or whatever. how big of a fan of the show they were.
How many people do you think? You can't even see like a volume control on it. I don't know. Can you switch from AM to FM? Is it I guess it's FM only. And then that just looks terribly uncomfortable to try and put that on your ear. Like that just, I can't imagine how long a kid would have kept that on their ear before they just like threw it on the ground and smashed it. Because that doesn't look too comfortable. Liam, while we're talking about items Batman Beyond related, how did you tell time when you were a kid? How did you keep track of time before cell phones were in your pocket?
Gosh, I mean, sometimes I had a wristwatch, though I was notorious for asking for a wristwatch for a Christmas or birthday and then never wearing it.
So you clearly did not have the Batman Beyond pocket watch, complete with cane, with an attached chain that you could just clip to your pants, shirt, I don't know, it's clipped to something. Yeah, that was one of the more unique items that I can't imagine they sold too many of. It's a nifty looking pocket watch, I guess, if you're into that sort of thing. The chain is sort of this metallic red, and the watch itself is red, and it's got the Batman Beyond logo with the word mark in the middle of it. But who would ever want this? Why?
Yeah, I don't know of too many kids in general that were carrying pocket watches of any kind, much less a specifically Batman Beyond. It is a cool, like, this is something where if I tracked this down now for a reasonable price, if you had like a little display of Batman Beyond figures, maybe the old Kenner figures or whatever, Yeah, I feel like I could try to make this part of that display or something, but not an item I imagine was of high demand at the time it was originally released.
Yeah, we got three more items here that we'll cover, Liam. Two of them kind of go together, and that's going to be celebrating. Somebody here on this podcast is about to celebrate a birthday, and I think the best way to celebrate that would be with your very own Batman Beyond cake pan and matching Batman Beyond candle, which, best I can tell, you light the candle and it eventually will melt Batman Beyond down to nothing if you complete melting. I don't understand it, but this is kind of interesting. You could have your own Batman shaped cake, I suppose, if your parent wanted to do a fancy Batman cake. Cake pans, they're kind of cool, but this the Batman on the cake really doesn't look very healthy. It looks like they tried to make it look like it was made of cake or something like that. I don't know. It kind of looks like a rug, based on what I'm looking at here. It doesn't look delectable, based on what I'm seeing here. And then the Batman Beyond candle is another. It's got like, it's half of Batman Beyond, so he's going to be like sitting in your cake, and then he's got some sort of weird contraption. I could not for the life of you tell you what that is behind him. Is it a building? Is it pipes? Is it a castle? Is it like, is it, I could, is it spark plugs? I don't know, but he's like plastered half to the front of it, and then the candle is like floating above his head. It's very strange.
Yeah, I'm like, at first I'm like, oh, is it supposed to be like the city skyline? No. Is he in like a factory or something? I don't know. Maybe it. Yeah, it's confusing. And he's not posed in a way that like Batman
he's
Beyond.
Like giving an uppercut. Yeah, it almost looks like.
Yeah, or he's like he's doing like the end of what's that Breakfast Club? The end of Breakfast Club. The guy walking away and does the big fist pump and it freezes. Yeah, that's. I think he's doing the Breakfast Club fist pump. That's my official word on.
I love that. And then last but not least, maybe a gift for your birthday, Liam. We both wear glasses, but this probably was the weirdest one. It's like, who out there decided that they were gonna sell a Batman Beyond glasses case? It's interesting because it isn't just like a plain case with a sticker or logo slapped on it. It's got like this weird techie intricate inside of a computer design on the case itself, and then it has the Batman Beyond logo like smacked in the middle of it.
The cover, the top half is this black and gray circuitry, and then the bottom is this, you know, this bright, more vibrant red. And it's one of those things where like at first I was like, when we saw this, I thought, okay, someone just put a sticker on a glass case. This is not, but by golly, it does have the official DC Comics trademark on the back of it. So this is a real item, and it actually spawned a memory in me that I had, which is something I put out the call on Twitter to /X with no avail this week. When I was like 7 or 8 years old, I had a Batman Beyond pair of sunglasses. And Google and eBay, none of them can help me. I cannot find these things. I think we got them at like a dollar store or something. So who even knows? It might have been like after the show was heading towards the end of its run. This could have been like late 2000, early 2001 or something when I got these. But I know I had them. I remember wearing them during my first season of Little League Baseball sometimes. And they were black and blue frames. And then on the edge of the stems was actually like Batman. There's like a plastic extra piece that has a little Batman with his wings on it that sort of goes a little bit above where the stems of the frame end. So it's like they were not completely without, they didn't just like stamp the logo on the side or something and call it a day. They tried to make these a little bit more intricate, but I've tried every which way to Google these. I am hoping we're putting the call out into the universe. Somebody knows what I'm talking about and is going to send us a picture. My hopes are not high, but boy, I am
we'll send an eBay alert.
Yes, I am desperate to find these Batman Beyond sunglasses, mostly just because when we started talking about doing wacky merch, that was one of the first things I thought of, because like, oh, those are kind of strange because they're sunglasses, but they have like a little character on the side of the stems. That's kind of weird. And then I just went down this rabbit hole and I could not find it, no matter how many different combinations of words. And I put the quotes around the word so that it would only pull results that had all of those words in them. And I still couldn't find it. And I was just, I was driving myself half mad. So I'm begging someone to find these dollar store Batman Beyond sunglasses that have, that are now eluding me some almost 25 years plus later. So if anyone knows what I'm talking about, let me know. But yes, that's just a taste. As mentioned, there'll probably be a volume two, because as mentioned, there's a lot of Batman Beyond villains who had a couple appearances, but not a lot of toys or comic book appearances. So, you know, stay tuned for our next Batman Beyond villain character spotlight episode, because we may delve back into the pile of wacky Batman Beyond merch into the future when we come back to this sort of topic.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's we'd love to hear it. If you have some weird Batman Beyond thing, tweet it at us or send it to us on Instagram, and we'd love to share it with our followers. And who knows, maybe if people like this, there's a plethora of other tie-in merchandise for the other cartoons. So yeah. Maybe not Zeta or Static, but there's definitely a lot for the other cartoons, Superman and Batman. So lots of stuff that we can cover and look at and laugh about and secretly covet if people want to hear and see more.
That's absolutely right. And as mentioned, birthday's coming up. You still time to get me that cake pan. let me know. Slide into those DMs if you're interested. But no, that will begin to wrap us up on this very unique dual character spotlight episode. Thanks everybody for listening, whether you do so on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts shut down. I don't know if I don't know where all those people went. Hopefully they're still listening on something. Perhaps on the Pod Tower YouTube channel, as Cal mentioned at the top of the show, you can subscribe there and you'll get content not just from us, but from Jump on the Batwagon and Tim Talk as well. Would appreciate you subscribing there. That's the best free way to help support the show, is to subscribe to us on whatever platform you listen on. And if your app of choice lets you leave us 5 stars, do that. And in the case of, I think it's still just Apple Podcasts that's letting you leave full reviews. Mm-hmm. So we do appreciate those. And as Cal mentioned, if we do get a new one of those and it's 5 stars, we will read it on the show and even send you a little gift in the mail as a thank you for doing so. But that's a great free way to support us. There are a couple of other more direct monetary ways you could support us. One is to head into our show notes. There's a couple of links there. One is to our store page. You could pick yourself up a hat or a shirt or a mug, perhaps a Jimmy DeBoss mug, which our friend James from Watchtower Database was showing off on his social media this week. Very, very appreciative to have kindred spirits in this DCAU fan community who just lock in on weird, funny jokes from a tie-in comic and support us financially in buying one. So appreciate Absolutely. That, James. But yeah, you can buy yourself a little bit of merch there, or if you're there's also a donate button in the links down there where you can support us directly. And we have a few people who support us monthly. We appreciate it. Buys me and Cal a cup of coffee. And helps us keep motivated and helps buy us like I said a couple cups of coffee on those Friday nights when Cal's trying to get the edit done and he's got to power on through. We definitely appreciate it then. So we thank our monthly contributors as well. But Cal, we are, as mentioned, wrapping up the month of January. We are moving on to a new month, and I think it's only appropriate. It's been a little while. I think it's time we head back to those sunny skies over the town of Dakota.
That's right, Liam. We will be returning to the sunny skies of Dakota and covering some Static Shock next week. And we will actually be wrapping up the final episode of season two. Hard to believe we are through two full seasons there. We've jumped around a little bit, but recently with our reviews, we've been knocking out those early season episodes. And we wrap things up with episode or season two's final episode, which is entitled Jimmy. It's a most notably memorable, probably because it is a what some would dub a very special episode of Static. It actually touches mm-hmm. on the subject of school violence and gun violence and lots of real world implications here. So I'll be interested to see how that's handled. I don't remember maybe watching it one time. That was probably 20 some years ago. So if we did watch it, it has not stuck with me other than knowing that the episode existed. So excited to see that how that works out for us.
Yeah, as we mentioned, Static sometimes flew into that world of edutainment almost, but as we've talked about with people like Len Yulee, who worked on the show, that it obviously was not afraid to touch on real world subjects like gun violence, and specifically gun violence in schools, which I don't think there was any other superhero cartoon or any other cartoon period on TV that was going to touch that one with a 10-foot pole. So this is a pretty important and an interesting episode. Can't wait to talk about it. That'll be next week. But until then, I'm Liam.
And I'm Cal.
And we'll talk to you on the next episode of the DCAU Review.
Bye-bye.